Okay, so everybody knows, it's pointed out often, that Megillat Esther is the only book in Tanakh that doesn't have God's name in it. Now, is that true? Is that true that this is the only book that doesn't have God's name in it? Actually, it's not true. There's another book that does not have any mention of God in it. Any guesses? You can get this. Yov has God's name in it. It's another one of the Megillot. Shir HaShirim has no name of God in it. Kohelet also does not have Shem Havaya, Yud Kev Av Keh in it, but does have Shem Elohim. But nevertheless, Megillat Esther does not have God's name in it, and that seems to be pretty strange. Why would a book of Tanakh not have God's name in it? And so there's the famous answer that everybody knows, and it's a good answer, which is that Esther min haTorah minayin, right? And so how do we know Esther from the Torah? And it says, Astira fanayim mehem, I will hide my face from them. And so the reason Esther, Megillat Esther, does not have God's name in it is because we're living in a time when we don't see open miracles, when we don't have Nevi'im that are telling us everything that's going on, and we have to look for God, right, in a more hidden fashion. And so Megillat Esther is reflecting the Persian period when the period of open miracles is finished. Okay, that's a great possibility that the Megillat Esther was not written for the Jewish population; it was written for non-Jews. In fact, the Gaonim take up that position, and they say the reason why God's name is not in Megillat Esther is because the non-Jews, the Persians, are going to put it in their books, and they're going to change the name of God into a pagan god. So better not to put any name of God at all. That way, they can't corrupt it. Right? Okay, good. That's another possibility. Okay, so even if we go with the first possibility, it still doesn't explain the irreligious nature of Megillat Esther. I can understand why God is hidden, right, Hester Panim, but he shouldn't be hidden from the mouths of the heroes, Mordechai and Esther. Why doesn't Mordechai and Esther pray? Why don't the people pray? Right? What's going on? So immediately everybody says, well, they must have prayed because, look, they fasted. The first source on your handout, there's a bunch of handouts back there and some here too. Says, Esther says, go and gather all the Yehudim and Nimsim b'shushan b'shushan v'tzumu alai v'al tochlu v'al tishtu shiloshet yamim laila v'yom. And if they're fasting, then naturally they must be praying also. However, this is not something to be taken for granted, because usually when we have fasting, we do also have praying. For example, in Yonah, when Yonah comes and says, in 40 days, Nineveh is going to be overturned, and everybody wears sackcloth, and this is source number two, and they say, you should all start praying. Vayizak, vayomed pasuk zayin, mitam hamelech ugdolav lemor ha'adam v'behema v'abakar v'atzon al yitamu me'uma, v'al yed'u, ma'umayim al yishtu, v'itkansu sakim ha'adam v'behema v'ikr'u el Elohim, v'choska v'yashubu ish midarko ra'a, u'mine chamas asher v'chapehem. So this is the non-Jewish residents of Nineveh, the most evil city in the whole world. They fasted, and they also prayed. And elsewhere, David, when he fasts over his child, says Vayasom David Som, Ubavalan Vashachab Asa, but also says Vaybakesh David El Elohim. He also prays to God. And Ezra says Venatsuma Venavakesha Me Elohenu Alzot Vyatelanu. We fasted, but we also prayed. And then Nehemiah also says Vaevkevat Avelayamim Vayhisam Umit Palilifne Elohim Hashne Elokeshamaim. So everywhere else where we find fasting, we also find prayer, except in Megillat Esther. There is one place that we do have fasting without prayer. This is good for a quiz. And that's by Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim is one of the very evil kings. And in the very chapter, a very famous story, when Baruch brings Yirmiyah's prophecies, and he takes them and tears them up and throws them into the fire, and he does it on a fast day. This is the day that Nebuchadnezzar came and destroyed Ashkelon. And so they're fasting, but obviously it's not for religious reason. They're just mourning that they now lost their sovereignty and they lost Ashkelon. So there you have a tzom without praying from a very evil person, right, of Jehoiakim. So fasting should always go with prayer. So therefore in Esther, when it says they fasted, Okay, that's good, but the fact that it doesn't say that they prayed is a glaring absence. Okay, so that's the basic question. And I want to, this is an old question, and I want to go back through Jewish history and delineate three different ways that that Jews have approached this question. And the first way is to say, very simply, that Megillat Esther is not a holy book. The reason it doesn't have prayer and God's name or anything like that is because it's not a prophetic book and in fact does not belong in our canon. Now, very famously, who held this view? An entire group of people that held this view, it seems, is the Dead Sea Scrolls. Right? Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, were discovered in 1947, and in the first cave we found two Yeshayahu scrolls, and then we found 11 caves altogether, and we found copies of every book of Tanakh. And, for example, Sefer Tehillim, we have 39 copies, and then Sefer Dvarim and books of Chumash, we have dozens of copies. And we have every single book of Tanakh, at least some piece of it, except for Megillat Esther. So it seems that the Dead Sea sect did not believe in Megillat Esther. That was not part of their canon.
Maybe it never reached them.
It should have reached them. I mean, they had every other book. They weren't so far away. They came from Jerusalem. They were in contact with them. So it seems that they didn't have it. Now, there are some scrolls called Proto-Esther. These are scrolls that seem to have some words, phrases that are similar to words in Megillat Esther. And one scholar, Shemayahu Talmon, argues that even though this is not an Esther scroll, it makes reference to Esther. And they must have known about Esther even though they didn't actually have it. However, most scholars say that this is nothing to do with Megillat Esther. It's another kind of Persian tale genre, but that they did not have Megillat Esther. And that's the majority view. They didn't have it. We don't know why they didn't have it, but we can guess that it doesn't look like a religious book, so they didn't think it was important to have. So that's the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, what about the rabbis? If you go down to source number 6, we see that some rabbis also held that Megillat Esther is of questionable status. Shmuel is the most important, but we'll see that coming up. Amar Shmuel Bar Yehuda. Shalcha lehem Esther l'chachamim, kav'uni l'dorot. Esther sent a message to the rabbis and said, establish me for generations. In other words, include me in Tanakh, right? Make Purim a good holiday. Now, why'd she have to do that? Obviously, some rabbis didn't want to, so she had to try to convince them. And they sent her back, no, we can't, because kin'at me'oreret alenu leben ha'omot. You're going to incite ill will of the nations, because we're going to be celebrating this holiday when we destroyed the other people, and they're going to say, you know, you're celebrating at our downfall, and they're not going to be happy with this. And so it's better not to celebrate Purim, and they're better not to include Megillat Esther. And she sent back, Shalcha lehem, kevar ketuva ani al divrei hayamim lemalchei Medai uParas. The story's already written, as it says in the end of Megillat Esther. The story's already written in the annals of the Persians, so they already know the story. You're not telling them anything new. So therefore, you should include me. Okay. Then the Gemara goes on. I'm not going to read the entire thing. And says, why not write me down? And there's a pasuk that says we should write it three times and not four times. And it's already written three times about Amalek, right? In Shemot, in Devarim, and by Shaul. And so we can't write it a fourth time. But then they find a way to do another midrash in the pasuk and says, no, we really could find it and write it down a fourth time. Okay, now skip to the second page. And then here we have the view of Shmuel. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Shmuel is the first generation Amora in Babel. Esther, ena metame'a tayadayim. The book of Esther does not defile the hands. This gets into a little bit of a technical halacha, which is that any holy book, any holy scroll, if you touch it, it makes your hands defiled. Now this seems to be paradoxical. Why should something holy make you tameh? And the reason that the Gemara brings is because that Kohanim, when they ate Truma has to be Tahor all the time. So they used to take their Truma and hide it in the Aron with the other Sfarim, so that nobody else would come in and take it. But what happened then is that mice came to eat the food, and then they also started eating the scrolls, and all the scrolls were being destroyed. So Chazal made a decree that scrolls make everything tameh. So if you put your food with the scrolls, then your food will be tameh, and that way it keeps the food out of the Aron and preserves the scrolls. Okay, so now this is only true for scrolls that are part of Tanakh, scrolls that are holy. But any other scroll, just a ketuvah or a shtar, would not be metameh et hayadayim. So here, when Shmuel says that Megillat Esther does not defile the hands, he's in effect saying that Megillat Esther is not part of Tanakh. That's the way majority of scholars understand it. Professor Lyman says, no, it doesn't mean, it still means part of Tanakh, it just means it's not prophetic. Which leads to an interesting conclusion that there could be non-prophetic books in Tanakh, which leads to another problem. But either way, it's not part of Tanakh, or it's not prophetic. That's what Shmuel said. And we understand why, right? There's no God's name. It's not, it doesn't seem to be a religious book. So now, does this mean, the Gemara asks, Lememra disavah Shmuel ester lav beruach ha-kodesh nemra? This means that Shmuel thinks that Megillat Esther is not prophetic, but he himself said, Ha'amar Shmuel ester beruach ha-kodesh nemra. He says it was prophetic. So rather, we have to make an interesting answer. It says, Ne'emra likrot ve'lo ne'emra lichtov. It was taught to be read, but not to be written. In other words, you can recite it by heart, but you can't write it down. Right? This is a kind of kri uchtiv. There's many places in Tanakh where there's a word that you read, but it's not written. Or it's written one way, but not read the same way. So this is a kri uchtiv for an entire book. So we know, and there's some words that are only read, but not written at all. And in the Aleppo Codex and in good Tanakhs, the way they indicate it is by putting the nikudot, only the vowels for the letter, without consonants, and the consonants they put on the side. Then you have to combine them. So if we follow this opinion, then in our Tanakh, we would have to open up to Megillat Esther and find only pages and pages of nikudot, and you'd have to fill in the consonants all on your own. Okay, so we have this interesting balance. It is a prophetic book, but we can't write it down, and it's not mitameh tayadayim. Shmuel said this book is not the same as the other books, right? Well, he probably still celebrated Purim, but maybe like we celebrate Chanukah, even though the Book of Maccabees is not a Tanakh, right? It's just midrabanan. Okay, one other source that says that Megillat Esther does not have the same status as the other books is Levi bar Shmuel and Rav Huna bar Chiya Havuka Mitakne. This is source number 7. Mitpachot Sifre Debe Rav Yehuda. So these two students were fixing the Sefarim. They were putting cloths on the scrolls in the house of their teacher Rav Yehuda. And when they got to the scroll of Esther, Kimatu Megillat Esther Amre, Ha Megillat Esther Laba Emitpachat. They said this Megillat Esther does not need a cover. Because it's not a holy book, we don't have to treat it with the same amount of respect as the others. And then the teacher answers, Amar lehu, ki hai gavna name mechzeki afkiduta. This is irreverence. This smacks of being disrespectful. So there's some machloket here about the status. Actually, the controversy here is probably the fact that they said this without their teacher's permission. Right, because the context there is saying things, being disrespectful to rabbis. And so it could be that even the teacher agrees that it doesn't require a cover, but just the way that they did it. They went about it in the wrong way. Okay, so this is the first response. We look at Megillat Esther, we see there's no God's name, there's no prayers, there's no halachot, and it looks like it's not a religious book. And in fact, many people said, it is not a religious book, it doesn't belong to Tanakh. That these scrolls didn't have it, and some individual, a minority of sages, including most importantly Shmuel, say that this does not belong in Tanakh, and this is not a prophetic book, or has some level of prophecy, but not to be written down. Okay, so that's the first opinion. Now this opinion has not been accepted by mainstream Judaism, although we do find some hints in it. There is a general halakha that any holy book you're not allowed to touch with your hands, right? Even until today, when we want to roll a Sefer Torah, we use a talet or a cloth or something. But Megillat Esther, nobody's careful not to touch it, right? You ever see anybody, right, being careful not to touch a Megillat Esther? So the Achronim deal with this, and they say maybe it's because we follow this opinion that Megillat Esther is not metameh tayadayim. Right? So even though it's actually only a minority opinion, there are some achronim that say that we do follow it in certain instances. Okay. So that's the first response. The second response is to deny the question. This is why didn't Esther pray? Actually, she did pray. And it adds in words. Now, the most famous example of this is the Septuagint, right? The Greek translation of Megillat Esther. The famous story about the 70 sages translating, that was only about the Torah. Other books of Nevi'im and Ketuvim were translated later on. This was probably translated sometime around the 1st century BCE for the purpose of especially the Jews in Egypt who knew Greek but didn't know much Hebrew, and this was their Tanakh that they used. So in this case, they didn't only translate it, they translated and inserted some things, like the famous Yiddish version of Shakespeare, right, translated and made better, right, and improved. So here's a few examples. Number 8. On the first line, I bring you the NJPS translation, which is our Tanakh. It says, "But Esther did not reveal her kindred or her people as Mordechai had instructed her. For Esther obeyed Mordechai's bidding as she had done when she was under his tutelage." Fine. Now we read the LXX, right? 50-10-10 stands for 70. This is the NSRV translation of the Greek into English. "Esther had not disclosed her country. Such were the instructions of Mordechai. But she was to fear God and keep his laws, just as she had done when she was with him. Esther did not change her mode of life." Right, so what do we have here? God's name. Right? Improvement. And not only God's name, but also the fact if she's hiding her identity, well, how could she hide her identity and still keep kosher and Shabbat and all that? I mean, wouldn't they notice that she was doing things a bit differently? But it says, no, even though she did not disclose her identity, she still did everything the same way she did before. She was midakdek on every little halacha, nevertheless. Okay, so this is one way to answer the question, right? Why didn't she pray? She did pray, right? She did do everything. Why isn't God's name in there? It is in there, because we put it in. This is Septuagint, right? And that second example. Number 9. Our Tanakh says, "His advisors, Haman's, and his wife Zerah said to him, 'If Mordechai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish stock, you will not overcome him. You will fall before him in your ruin.'" In the Septuagint version, it says, "His friends and wife said to him, 'If Mordechai is of the Jewish people, and you have begun to be humiliated before him, you will surely fall. You will not be able to defend yourself because the living God is with him.'" So now we have the name of God not only in the mouth of Esther, but even Haman's wife and his advisors are also mentioning God. And source number 10. "Many of the people of the land profess to be Jews is at the end, for the fear of the Jews had fallen upon them." This, the professed, is a translation of mityahadim. Mityahadim could mean that they converted. But mityahadim, the hitpael, sometimes means to make believe, to feign. Like Amnon and Tamar, Amnon says, "You know, make believe that you're sick." It says vayitchal. He didn't actually become sick. He made believe he was sick. So often the hitpael means to make believe. So a lot of the Jews, that's why I say, profess to be Jews. They wanted to side with the Jews, the non-Jews, because of the fear. Okay. The Septuagint says, "And many of the Gentiles were circumcised and became Jews out of fear of the Jews." Right? It's introducing halacha. If they converted, they must have been circumcised also. No. In fact, the variations recorded in the Talmud are not in any copy of our Septuagint. So they're right. The Septuagint that we have, which comes from, preserved by the church, is not necessarily the original Septuagint. There's different versions of it. Okay. Now, besides these small changes in individual Pesukim, the Septuagint also has 6 extra paragraphs that we don't have in our Tanakh. Right? It's like when you buy the DVD version of the movie, right? The extra scenes, deleted scenes. So we have 6 new paragraphs that we didn't have before. So this is fantastic. And the 6 are, the first is, the edition A comes right before the Megillat Esther, before it begins, before chapter 1. And it says, "Mordechai had a dream," and we'll read a little bit of it. And the second one is Haman's royal edict. It says that they sent out letters to all of the communities, but we don't have a copy of the letter. So here they said, well, let's make up a copy of the letter. And so they figured out what it would have said, and they put that in also. Addition C is the prayers of Mordechai and Esther. Why didn't they pray? They did pray, and here are their prayers. Right? Okay, so good, we have them. Addition D was the story of Esther appearing before the king. And then addition E is Mordechai's edict. Right? He also sent out letters, and so now we have copies of that too. And addition F is the interpretation of Mordechai's dream. If you notice, these 6 editions actually have a chiastic structure. right? A and F are about Mordechai's dream. B and E is Haman's royal edict and Mordechai's royal edict. And C and D is Esther praying before she goes in and then coming into the king. I don't think this is on purpose. This is probably just a coincidence. It's a chiastic. But it happens to be that the entire Megillat Esther is chiastic. And I brought you this not because I'm going to discuss it. This could be a whole shiur in itself. But just so you can look at it on your own, on the next page, the chiastic structure of Megillat Esther. Okay, so let's look at a couple of these additions to Megillat Esther. Source number 11. It says, in the second year of the reign of Artaxerxes the Great, we're not sure who Ahasuerus is. There are a bunch of Persian kings named Xerxes and Artaxerxes, but usually most people think that Ahasuerus is Xerxes, who lived in around the year 485 BCE. The Septuagint, however, assumes that it's Artaxerxes, a bit later king. If it was Artaxerxes, then the Hebrew should have been Artashashta rather than Ahasuerus. But anyway, in the second year of his reign, the first day of Nisan, Mordechai had a dream, noises and confusion, thunder and earthquake, tumult on the earth. Then two great dragons came forward, both ready to fight, and roared terribly. At their roaring, every nation prepared for war to fight against the righteous nation. It was a day of darkness and gloom, of tribulation and distress, affliction and great tumult on the earth. And the whole righteous nation was troubled. They feared the evils that threatened them, and they were ready to perish. Then they cried out to God. And at their outcry, as though from a tiny spring, there came a great river with abundant water. Light came, the sun arose, and the lowly were exalted and devoured those in honor. Mordechai saw in his dream what God had determined to do, and after he awoke, he had it on his mind, seeking all day to understand it in every detail. So what does this introduce into the story that changes the way we read the story? Is that this is all of divine providence. It's all foretold in a dream before any of this happened. Right, so I mean, we all assume that this is divine providence, but here it says it explicitly. And not only that, but as it's retelling the story in the dream, they cried out to God. So all the Jews, there is prayer there, of course. These two great dragons, in addition F, it says that the two great dragons are Haman and Mordechai, and the spring, this tiny spring that comes forth, is Esther. And so every part of the dream has a nimshah. Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. So.
And she said, mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. Good. So, that's a natural assumption. Yesterday I was doing a poll among some of my friends and family members. Some of them are very staunch pshat people. Right. You tell them midrash, then they insult you. So I asked them what they think. Is there prayer in the Megillat Esther? They said, of course there's prayer because there's fasting. And fasting means prayer. Right. So I think that's a valid interpretation, right? And it could be even a Peshat interpretation. However, as I said in the beginning, usually when it talks about fasting, it does say prayer also. So it is a bit of interpretation, right? You do have to read in something there. Yeah. These are found in the Septuagint. Is the Greek translation that the church used as their Bible, right? Originally, they were not originally Christian. These are originally Jewish translations made for the Jews, just like today we have Art Scroll, right? Art Scroll is coming out with Art Scroll is coming out with an all English version because 90% they said 90% of Jews don't know Hebrew, and so therefore it should be an all English version. So it's the same thing, right? There's lots of Jews today that only know English and don't know Hebrew. There was lots of Jews during the Second Temple who only knew Greek, and so they needed a translation. And if you're going to translate, you also want to explain some things, right? Not just translate literally. Now, actually, we're not sure if they're translating from a Hebrew that's the same as ours, and the translator's adding these in, or if there did exist a Hebrew version that already had these additions in it. The second way is more uncomfortable, but is still possible, because among the Dead Sea Scrolls, we find copies even of Chumash that have additions in it. Right, extra stories, extra interpretations, glosses. So this is something that Second Temple writers did do. They would add in.
Can you just tell me what NLRSV stands for?
Yes, New Revised Standard Version. It's just a standard translation of the Bible. Okay. So that's edition A. Edition B, we have Mordechai's prayer. And so this Mordechai prayed to God, calling to remembrance all the works of the Lord. He said, O Lord, you rule as king over all things. For the universe is in your power, and there is no one who can oppose you when it is your will to save Israel. You know all things. You know, O Lord, that it was not in insolence or pride or for any love of glory that I did this and refused to bow down to this proud Haman. For I would have been willing to kiss the soles of his feet to save Israel. There's a midrash about soles of feet. But I did this so that I might not set human glory above the glory of God. And I will not bow down to anyone but you, who are my Lord, and I will not do these things in pride. Hear my prayer, and so on. So Mordechai is adding an interesting thing here, right? What question is does the reader have that he put this in Mordechai's prayer? Why didn't he bow down? Right? There's no law that you can't bow down to a human being. There's only a law that you can't bow down to idolatry. And so Mordechai, because of, it seems like, his own personal pride, put the entire Jewish people in danger. So in this prayer, Mordechai says, it wasn't for my own pride, it was for you. I wanted to stand up for the glory of God. Let's look at this person who's, you know, making himself all proud and looking like God. And I felt that this was not the proper thing to do, but I did it for your sake, not for my own sake. Good. I'm gonna get to the Midrashim in a few minutes. Then we have Esther's prayer. And she also has some issues that we have to question. And so first it says, all of Israel cried out mightily, for their death was before their eyes. Okay, so everybody prayed also. Then Queen Esther, seized with deadly anxiety, fled to the Lord. She took off her splendid apparel and put on the garments of distress and mourning, and so on. The next paragraph. And she says, ever since I was born, I have heard in the tribe of my family that you, O Lord, took Israel out of all the nations and our ancestors from among their forebears for an everlasting inheritance. And you did that for them, all that you promised. And now we have sinned before you, and you have handed us over to our enemies. Melech Esther never says why they get punished. Right? We don't know why the Jews are, what reason it is. So here's the answer. Because we sinned. Because we glorified their gods, you are righteous. You have known of all things, have knowledge of all things, and you have known that I hate the splendor of the wicked and abhor the bed of the uncircumcised and of the alien. You know my necessity, that I abhor the sign of my proud position, which is upon my head on days when I appear in public. I abhor it like a filthy rag, and I do not wear it on days when I am at leisure. And your servant has not eaten at Haman's table, and I have not honored the king's feast or drunk the wine of libations, and I have no joy from this, and so on. Right? So what exegetical questions is this coming to answer? We look at Esther and says, what's going on? She makes a nice life for herself up there in the palace, and she seems to be enjoying being the queen. To the extent that Mordechai even accuses her, right? It says, don't think that you can hide in the palace, right, and be safe when everybody else is being destroyed. So there is some sense that Esther is not doing the right thing here. So this prayer adds in. Esther says, I hate being the queen. I hate all the glory. What can I do? I have to sleep with the king, but I hate it every second. I never ate non-kosher, right? I never ate with Haman or ate any of these sacrifices. I kept all the laws, right? And so, therefore, God, please save us. Okay, so it's dealing not only with the issue of prayer, but also the other religious issues that come up with Esther going into the palace. Okay, now we have another addition, which just adds a nice, if you had to make this into a movie, this would be a great scene to add in. When Esther appears before the king, in the pshat, she just appears, and even though she's scared because the king might kill her, but the king sees her, and he's happy to see her, and he says, okay, whatever you want. But here it adds in a whole section. It says, on the third day, source number 14, when she ended her prayer, don't even say her fasting, her prayer, she took off the garments in which she had worshipped and arrayed herself in splendid attire, the majestically adorned, after invoking the aid of all-seeing God and Savior, she and her two maids with her, one she leaned gently for support, while the other followed, carrying her train. She was radiant with perfect beauty, and looked happy as if beloved, but her heart was frozen with fear. When she had gone through all the doors, she stood before the king and was seated on his royal throne, clothed with the full array of his majesty, all covered with gold and precious stones. He was most terrifying. Lifting his face, flushed with splendor, he looked at her in fierce anger. So this is, you know, the climax of, you know, what's going to happen. The queen faltered and turned pale and faint and collapsed on the head of the maiden who was in front of her. Then God changed the spirit of the king to gentleness, and in alarm he sprang from his throne and took her in her arms until she came to herself. He comforted her with soothing words and said to her, "What is it, Esther? I'm your husband. Take courage. You shall not die, for our law applies only to our subjects. Come near." And he raised the golden scepter to touch her neck with it. He embraced her and said, "Speak to me." He said, "I saw you like an angel of God, and I was shaken with fear." And while she was speaking, she fainted and fell again. And the king was agitated. Right? So you have this whole maiden in distress. At first he's angry, but she faints. This whole fainting spell. She says, "Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, anything you want." And besides that, we have the direct hashkacha pratit here, when God comes and actively changes his mind to be kind to Esther. Okay, so that's the Septuagint. It solves the problem, right? There's no prayer, there's no God. What's going on here? It solves the problem by adding it in, right? And it's based on an assumption. Well, you know, this is a holy book, and they did fast and all that, so there must have been prayer. And so, right, let's compose what we think might have been the prayers. And those compositions are interesting because they also bring up other exegetical problems that we might have had along the way. Okay, this approach is also, that approach is not taken by Chazal. Chazal don't add in any words, of course. However, the same ideas, they do introduce, right? They're not putting it into the words, but they're interpreting it in a very similar way. So, a couple of examples. Source number 15. It says that here the same scene. She was standing in the court, in the inner courtyard, and Amada bi Levi, kevan shehigia lebet haslamim nistalka himena shechina, as she had to walk through the corridor where there's idols, the shechina left her. And she said, "Eli, Eli, lama azavtani." Right, it's from Mizmor Kafbet. That's the Mizmor that we say on Purim. So we say it because Esther said this Mizmor when she was about to go in. She says, "So God, why have you forsaken me? Are you judging me for things that I was forced to do, as if I wanted to do them? Right? All these things that I have to do, I'm forced to. Don't judge me for bad now. Speaking up on the fact that in Mizmor 22, first it talks about the caliph, a dog, and then the lion. She says, "Are you punishing me because I call the king a dog? Even though you should be respectful to a king. Okay, I'll call him a lion." Right? That's better. So then this is Vayhi kirot ha-melech et Esther ha-malka. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, shlosha malachei asheret nizdamnu la be'ota sha'a. So three angels came to help her. This is kind of like the two servants in the Septuagint. Echad she'egbia et savara ve'echad she'mashach chut shel chesed aleha. One lifted her up, and one made her look beautiful. Ve'echad she'matach et ha-charvit. And one extended his scepter. And how much did he extend it? Some say from 2 to 12, or 16, or even 24, and some say even 60 amot. You know, they're showing this is another, the same idea, that the angel is making him more appreciative, more receptive to the queen. So you have the same motif in the Septuagint editions and in the Midrash. So the Midrash is not, Midrash of course comes later, but it's not making it up out of nowhere. This was in a very old and common tradition. Source number 16, what do we do about Esther sleeping with the king? And the Septuagint says that she did, but she was under duress. What could she do? The Gemara gives a couple of similar answers. Abaye says, Esther karka olam haita. She was completely passive, just like the soil of the earth. Rava amar hanat atzman shane, that if in general this is, you know, if someone asks you to do some incest, you have to lay your life rather than do it. However, if they're asking for their own personal benefit and not just to make you violate your religion, then that would also be allowed. Right? He wasn't doing it dafka to make her violate something that she thought was important. So the Midrash deals with that. Midrash also deals with Shabbat and Kashrut. How did she keep Shabbat? The pasuk says she had seven maidens. So why seven maidens? One free day of the week, so then she got this one, then she knew, oh, say Shabbat again, right? And how about the food? Vaishaneha et narotea says that they treated her somewhat differently. How did they treat her differently? Amarav, shechila machal yehudi, they actually gave her kosher food, right? She requested kosher meals. I don't know how she got that, and they're still able to hide her identity. But Shmuel says, Shechila kadle de chazire. He gave her hinds of pork. Right? Now remember who Shmuel is? The bag, the nice fatty part of it. Shmuel is the one that said before that Megillat Esther is not a holy book and we don't accept it. Right? He also interprets it the way it seems to be, that she probably ate pork. She had, probably had to eat pork when she was there. Although there is one version from the Aruch, Gaonic dictionary, that says the chizre instead of chazire, chizre like chazire, the head of lettuce rather than pork. So that would make it better. But no other manuscript has that. Okay, Rabbi Yochanan amar zir'onim. No, she gave her seeds, so she was able to keep kosher. Okay, so that solves all the problems of Esther. Now, what about Mordechai? Why didn't he bow? And so there's a beautiful midrash that says he made himself, well, the other famous midrash is he crocheted an idol onto his shirt so that bowing down to him would be, in effect, bowing down to an idol. That's one answer. And the second answer we find in this midrash is that they asked Mordechai, why aren't you bowing down? And he says, Rabbi Levi, this is source number 18, Amar lehem Mordechai, Moshe Rabbeinu is here lanu b'Torah, Arur ha'ish asher yaseh pesel u'masecha. The curse is the one who makes an idol, and v'rasha hazeh oseh atzmo avodat kochel. Now he's making an idol, he makes himself into a god. V'yeshua Navi is here lanu, chadulu lachem min ha'adam asher neshama ba'apo, ki bameh nechshav hu. Right? Don't have such great respect for mere human beings. V'lod ela she'ani istagnin istagnatirin shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu shekol shivatim noldu b'chutz la'aretz v'zikenai nolad be'eretz Yisrael. Remember that Mordechai is Ish Yemini from Binyamin. I was born in Israel, so I have special status. I don't have to bow down to him. So they went down back to Haman and said, look, he has a good point. He doesn't need to bow down to you. He's special. Right? So, you know, let's say Haman should be convinced by that argument, right? So what do you say, Haman? So Haman gives actually a very good proof. He knows his Tanakh. He says, your ancestors bow down to my ancestor. Right, we know if Haman is from Amalek, and Amalek is the grandson of Esav. And Yaakov and his entire family did bow down to Esav. So he says, they bow down to Esav, you should bow down to me as well. Right? So good, Haman was learned. But then Mordechai points out insightfully that yes, all the other 11 brothers did bow down, but Benjamin was not born yet. And Benjamin did not bow down; they bow down. Therefore, I don't have to bow down either. Okay. So that sums up response number two. Right. The first response is this is not. There's no prayer. There's no God's name here. We're going to reject the book. The second response is. It doesn't say it explicitly, but of course there was prayer. Of course Esther kept all the laws. Of course God was involved at every step. It doesn't need to say it. It's just assumed. So the third response, I'd like to take the Megillah more at its face value and not read in that much, but at the same time, hold it up as a holy book. Can we balance, is it possible to balance those two things? And I think it's possible if we read the Megillah as a veiled criticism, a kind of a parody. A parody of who? Well, first of all, it's a parody of the Persians. I mean, you read the first couple of chapters, it describes Achashverosh's party. That's just over the top. I mean, whatever fancy wedding you've been to, this is like 100 times more, describing all the drinking and the different materials they used. And then describing his harem and how they prepared each one 6 months sitting in oil. I mean, is that good for your skin? I don't even know. So this is making fun of. I mean, you see, people are impressed. People watch the Grammys, right? They look at all the dresses, and, right? So we're very impressed by these things. But this is making fun of it. This is don't be impressed by all this materialism and you know, it's so much that it just becomes disgusting. So on the one hand, it's making a parody of the Persians and all their power. But at a deeper level, it's making fun of the Jews who are living there and enjoying this party, right? And the Jews who are impressed by all this opulence and majesty and power, right? Rather than being impressed by what they should be impressed by. And there's a few midrashim that do seem to follow this path. Very famous ones. Number 19 says, Hadassah Shema, She has two names. Her name is Esther and Hadassah. My wife's name is Esther, so I can't make fun of the name. However, it just so happens that it's not a very good Jewish name. Right? It comes from Ishtar, which is the goddess of love in the Babylonian pantheon. And the Rabbi Nechemiah knew this. He says, Hadassah Shema. Her real name was Hadassah. V'lama nikret Esther. Why was she called Esther? Shayu umot ha'olam korin ota al shum Istahar. So because the other nations would call her based on the Babylonian goddess Ishtar. So this is strange that the heroine of the story should have a name of a Babylonian goddess. And not only her, but also, of course, Mordechai. Mordechai's name comes from Marduk, who was the head god of the Babylonian pantheon. So this already says something about them, right? That they are taking on these Persianized names. You know, not only are they in Galut, but they take on all the trappings of Galut also. And look how it describes Mordechai. He is Ish Yehudi, it's true, but he's also, number 20, Asher Hogla Mirushalayim, Im Hagola Asher Hogletaim Yechonya Melech Yehuda, Asher Hogla Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel. Right, what's the key word in this pasuk? Galut? I mean, how often can you say that? He's in Galut. Okay, we know that. Now, why is it so bad to be in Galut? Didn't God send them there in the first place? How is that a criticism? It's a criticism because they should have been back, right? This is the year 485. The Beit HaMikdash was built in the year 516. So it's already up for 30 years. And, I mean, and they were already allowed to go back from Cyrus the Great in 539. So they have already a few decades. They should have been there, and they should have been in the Beit HaMikdash. Mordechai himself is from the tribe of Benjamin, right?
Yeah, but he was actually born in Benjamin because
no.
He himself was.
Oh, okay. If you say that he himself was exiled, then he would have to be about 150 years old. So another better interpretation is that Mordechai Ish ben Kish Ishimini. So it could be that Kish, his grandfather, was the one who was exiled. So he's the grandson of someone who went into exile. That would fit the chronology better. Okay, number 20. It says that they made a feast with kelim, vashkot bichle zahav, v'kelim kelim shonim. Different kinds of vessels. What does this mean, different kinds of vessels? Mishunim miba'ele. Should have been maybe strange vessels. Amarava, yatsa bat kol, v'amra lahem. Rishonim kalum ipne kelim, v'atem shonim bahem. Says the first generation were exiled because they misused the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash, and now you are repeating that that sin and doing it also. In other words, they were using in the party of Achashverosh, they're using the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash. Now I don't know if they were literally using them, because Ezra says that Cyrus returned them to the Jews so they could build the Beit HaMikdash. Maybe he kept some of them, but whether it's literal or not, the point is that they're sitting here making a feast with the king when they should be making a feast, so it's an insult when they should be making a feast in the Beit HaMikdash. Along these lines, number 21 says he showed him showing off all his wealth. Achashverosh baratot oshir kevod malchuto mar biyoseh bar chanina melamed shelavash bigdei kihuna. Achashverosh came out dressed in the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. And the Jews saw this and they were okay with it. The same words are used to describe both the Kohanim of the Kohen Gadol and the clothing of Achashverosh as well. Shalut Hamidah bet Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Mipneman itchaybu sonehen shel Yisrael shebaoto ador kelaya. Why did the enemies of Israel, as euphemism for Israel, why did they need to get destroyed? Why were they deserving? So the teacher says, why don't you say? Because they enjoyed from the meal of Achashverosh. Right? They didn't just go there to show patronage. They really enjoyed it. They were Persianized. They were acculturated. They forgot their identity. Only the Jews of Shushan enjoyed that meal. What about all the others in the rest of the provinces? So they said, you say, because they bow down to idolatry, That was basically the same thing. They lost their sense of identity and instead went to other places. Now, there seems to be a lot of hints to that this is really the pshat of the Megillah. This is from Rabbi Leibtag. Right? It's funny to quote someone who's speaking at the same time as you, right? But this is very insightful. And he says, how is the palace of the Achashverosh described? It says, this is the source number 22. Everybody knows that kol ish v'isha asher yabol ha-melech el chasar ha-pinimit asher lo yikare echat ha-tolamit levad ha-me'asher yoshit lo ha-melech et shavit ha-zahav v'chaya. And I wasn't called. So, in other words, that we have a lot of descriptions of the outer courtyard, right, where you can wear the street of the city where they were put on their sackcloth, and then the outer courtyard where Mordechai is, and then the inner courtyard where there's Ro'eh Pnei HaMelech, there's his closest courtiers can go, and then the inside where the king sits, and you could only go there once a year, specially dressed, otherwise you die. Sounds like the Kohen Gadol and the Kodesh Kodeshim. Right, so it's purposely describing the Achashverosh's palace, like the Beit HaMikdash, as a parody. You think this is what you look up to, this is what you worship, right? Rather than the Beit HaMikdash, the word Bira, means capitals, only appears twice in Tanakh, once about Yerushalayim HaBira, and the other time here Shushan HaBira. Right? There's a one-to-one parallel between these two. It's a hidden criticism, right? This is not the, I mean, explicitly, the basic message is, we were in danger, and God saved us. And even though God is hidden sometimes, we know that his hand is behind the scenes. But at a deeper level, this is a hidden criticism of the people. And we know that Nevi'im come and criticize them all the time, in an explicit way, right? But sometimes, a parody, if you kind of make fun of yourself, that could be more effective than any explicit, right? If you want to kind of make fun of Fox News or CNN, all these news channels, I mean, you can write a whole dissertation about things, strange things they do, or you can watch 5 minutes of John Stewart, right? And you see right away that parody is very effective. And I think this explains another part of, we keep saying laws, right? The laws of the king comes up many times in Megillat Esther. Look at source number 23. It says, "Veshitiyach hadat en ones." There was a rule for drinking that said no restrictions. You had to follow this rule very strictly, not to restrict anyone's drinking. Right? It's a parody of law. Right? Or again, "Vayomer haMelech haChamim yodei ha'etim kichem devar haMelech lifnei kol yodei v'dat v'din." Any time the king wanted to know something, he would always ask his legal advisors to know exactly what the law is, what to do. So we see the king being so makpid on every law, right? What's the criticism? Are the Jews also following their laws with the same amount of zealousness? And 25, ki chetav asher nichtav b'shem ha-melech v'nachtom b'tabat ha-melech en la-ashiv. Once the king says something, that law cannot be overturned. Now, I mean, this is also silly. There's no way you can run a government for centuries without overturning any law. And in fact, they do overturn the law, right? Not explicitly, they say they can defend themselves. But the point is, they take their laws very seriously. How about the Jews? Are you taking the Torah law as seriously as they are? So I think if you put these all together, you see. So why isn't there? Getting back to the original question, why isn't God mentioned? Why isn't there prayer in Megillat Esther? Maybe it's a reflection of the state of the Jews that they weren't praying enough. Right? They didn't have God on their minds enough. And so we're meant to feel a little bit uncomfortable when we read it, because we say, well, where is God? Where's the laws? Where's the prayer? What's going on? And then we think to ourselves and say, well, maybe this is what the state of the Jews are, and I wonder if we have some of that also. So in the end, this Mes Megillat Esther seemed to be a little bit of a downer, right? That this has all the criticism. On the other hand, of course, it still retains its original sense of talking about the greatest miracle, a hidden miracle that we have. And it's even a greater miracle because the Jews didn't deserve to get saved, but God saves them anyway. And that's why the last source, the source number 26, not by accident, right? Shem Havaya, see? I had to repeat source number 20 twice in order to do that, but there's still 26 sources, at least in number. It says, why don't we say Hallel on Purim? And we say, because reciting the Megillah is the Hallel. when we recite the Megillah and see that God saves us, even though we don't deserve it, but He comes through anyway because hopefully we'll learn from it and we'll make teshuva and we'll do better, then that's the greatest praise of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we can possibly have. So in our time also, we need lots of prayers for peace, and especially in this new Middle East that we don't know what's going to happen. And our prayers are all the more important, and we need God's mercy more than ever. So have a happy upcoming Purim. Thank you so much.